Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon. The last great civil rights movement of the 20th century is not yet complete. The struggle to be treated with justice in the American social and legal system still faces homosexuals, gay men, and lesbian women. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin, New York Times editorial writer and co-author of the book Out for Good, which documents this struggle. Haven't all Americans who were not landed WASP men faced this same challenge?
It's even more basic than that. I mean, it's whether you can be an honest human being, honest with yourself and honest with the people in your life. There's nothing more basic than that. And that's why the policy, don't ask, don't tell, whether it's a military policy or whether it's the classical Southern policy or whether it's sort of the general cultural thing, don't tell me and you won't bother me. That's why it doesn't work, because it forces people to be dishonest. And that's what this movement and most movements are about, simply for the freedom to be, for people to be whom they are.
Dudley Clendenin is an editorial writer for the New York Times. He has also edited a book of essays called The Prevailing South, and he is the author of the text of Homeless in America, a book of photographs. Along with Adam Nagorny, a reporter for the New York Times, Clendenin offers us a glimpse into a world virtually unknown to most heterosexuals, and indeed to many gays and lesbians. Bill Russell and I invited Dudley Clendenin to join us in conversation at St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, a remarkable church dedicated to bringing its message to all people. Dudley Clendenin, I am quite charmed by something that I think is called a magic eye. It's a digital image that looks just kind of chaotic and colorful at first look. But then when you focus on one thing, your eye plays tricks with you, and you can see in three-dimensional, and it gives you a whole different image. I got the sense in reading Out for Good and in thinking about the gay rights movement that in a very real sense you had focused on one part of radically changing times and helped me see all of those 30-some years with a new clarity. Does focusing on the gay rights movement, I mean, does that play for you?
Yeah, it does, because the thing, when we first looked at this subject, because no one had written a history of the modern gay rights movement, and we began talking to people one by one, we had to find who we should talk to, and we had to ask them who else we should talk to. And we did 700 interviews with more than 300 people, and it was a crowd. And then we had to find the pathway, the structure of the movement through that crowd. We had to find the focus, you know, that you're talking about. And the hard thing about this book and that movement was doing that, because it has no central leader. There's no Martin Luther King in the gay rights movement. There's
well, and by definition, it didn't have a leader, right?
By definition, or any other way you count it.
No. No.
That's not to say that a lot of people didn't try.
A lot of people at a lot of different times. And there are people who have who were important at the beginning, who had energy and who had ideas, who had passion, and who are still there and who are still important. Almost all of them are unknown to the larger culture. And they were unknown to us, I should say. And we had to find them, but they're not, they never became famous like the people who came from Atlanta who were king's lieutenants, or the women in the women's movement. They are in this book, and but they all had to be found, and we had to do a lot of accumulating and then a lot of cutting away to find the bones of the movement.
I was really surprised at how many ways the gay and lesbian rights movement cut across all the other things happening in the world, and in America in particular, in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
Well, it's the only group that cuts across all other groups, you know. I mean, there are two things about it. One is that gays and lesbians are the only group whose members have to stand up and declare themselves in order to be discriminated against. You know? We're invisible. You know? I mean, nobody can say of me or anyone else, you know, you are homosexual unless I do, or the other person says who is. And the other thing is that it's the only minority group that contains every other group in the culture. Because the only thing that binds homosexuals together are feelings, feeling different in childhood without knowing why, feeling attracted to someone probably the same gender as you get older, and then feeling rejected because of it.
And that invisibility is a very important part of your story, isn't it?
It is, because people had to choose. People can pass if you're an African American, if you're of Asian blood, if you're Italian, you know, if you're a woman, if you're Jewish, if you're almost any other group. There's some record, there's some visible sign, there's some documentation. You can't fake being something else permanently, but gay and lesbians can pass. And so they have to make the decision not to. And it's under attack. It's in frustration. It's in being harassed or in being denied their rights that one by one, a certain number at different times, have made that decision and have formed something called a movement.
This is Dudley Clendenin. Bill Russell and I are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, with invited guests and Dudley Clendenin. And we're all going to be back in just a moment. Please be with us. We are back. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin, and Bill Russell and I are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta. We went away talking about And They Become a Movement. Out of the African-American tradition, the black civil rights movement, I got a sense from John Lewis, mm-hmm. a congressman here in Atlanta, that movement is a verb, to move. And I sort of had a sense of that as I was reading about what it took to get people energized around this issue. From invisible to movement is a long, long trip, isn't it?
It's a long trip, and it's a highly individual trip. It's a very personal. You know, the phrase in the late 60s, in the radical years, was politics is personal. You know, the personal is political. And that's not more true of any movement than this one. People, you know, this is a movement that learned from the women's movement, learned from the anti-Vietnam War movement, learned from the black civil rights movement and the black power movement, learned from all those movements, but then had to grow as the rest of them faded, you know, and had to grow sort of by itself against an increasingly conservative culture. And that's been one of the themes about it. And it's only grown under attack. Mm-hmm. That's really...
Yeah, when times got good, nothing happened.
No, nothing happened. And in the small sense, when the police raided the Stonewall Inn in the bar in the Greenwich Village in New York.
In 1969.
30 years ago, at the end of this month. That was an attack. And when they fought back, that was the first public resistance. But it has been things like that on that small scale or larger that have been... become the form of the movement through the last three decades.
You start your book, and I guess conceptually the start of this movement with Stonewall. And I think early on you say at that time, 1969, homosexuality was a crime, it was a sin, and it was a disease.
Right, we were crazy.
Yeah. And I have a soft spot in my heart for stories that with happy endings. So I read all the way to the end of your book. And
at which time it was no longer...
Well, there was progress. I mean, there was obviously progress, but it is not, you know, it's not over.
No,
this yet. Is... This is not... Frankly, I was looking for that last chapter that you haven't written yet, mm-hmm. because it's not a happy ending, necessarily. There seems to have been substantive improvements with respect to all three of those. But there still seems to be a lot of resistance in the community at large.
Yeah, we haven't seen the end of this story yet. I don't know when we will. There, you know, in one way, and I think it is true, this movement has come farther, faster than any other civil rights movement in American history.
And you do think of this as a civil rights movement, don't you?
It is. It started as a movement of sexual liberation. among radicals. You know, that was what was in the air. But it shifted pretty quickly into a civil rights movement, more a middle class movement, under attack when Anita Bryant discovered it and became afraid for her children, you know. Then the sexual content, the basic sexual energy of the movement, was identified and became the issue again. But that's been the tension between the two, the civil rights and the movement for sexual liberation. It will never be resolved. And there's a big tension between men and women in the movement that will never be resolved because they have basically different kinds of interests. But lots of progress has been made if you consider that it started from zero. It's the only group that had no civil rights. You know, no right of assembly, no right to buy an ad in the Yellow Pages, no right to take out an ad in the newspaper to say, come meet with us. If you declared yourself, you were liable to be arrested or lose your license because, I mean, no psychiatrist could say even that he was or she was homosexual because she'd lose her license to help treat other homosexuals or anyone else, you know. So starting from zero, it's come a long way. We're not anymore insane by definition since 1973.
When that was changed, there right. Before 1973, well, it was insanity.
I'd like to take that a little further. I mean, that's the one place that disease part of the Trinity at the beginning, where there has been an unequivocal change, at least in terms of definitions and what is generally accepted to be current practice. But what it took to get the profession of psychiatry and psychology to make that move, to me, it's just an astounding story, and it's not pretty. The fact that it happened, I think, is a tribute to a few individuals, and ultimately, I think, the profession coming around. But what it took to get there is striking.
It's pretty dramatic, and at points was funny. And some of my favorite images in the book are when gay activists zapped psychiatric conventions and went racing up and took the stage, and psychiatrists standing on their chairs screaming, "Get out of here, you maniacs!" You know. It is very theatrical stuff, and theater as political pressure, and they were able to persuade the psychiatrists, first the board, you know, and then the whole population of psychiatrists in the country voted and decided it just didn't make any sense to keep a definition that was based on a perception of how the population felt to begin with. It wasn't a medical definition.
But it took one person, and I don't mean to diminish the importance of everybody that was involved in it. It sounded, you know, the way you report it, there was one person who, you know, had a fairly well-formed notion, but was at least willing to examine the evidence. And that willingness and the willingness to follow the evidence wherever it led was really the difference. I mean, one person really made a difference in this case.
Right. Yeah, this is a movement where often one person made the difference. I mean, the first person who stood up and said, you know, psychiatrists can't speak for me. You know, I'm homosexual and I'm perfectly sane was a man named Franklin Kameny. He was a Harvard-trained astronomer who'd been arrested by the police for suspicion, period. And it ruined his career. He was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know, and could get no job, and it radicalized him. And so he looked at things around him and said, this isn't right. I'm not crazy, and I'm not a criminal, and there's many of us as there are African Americans, and we deserve civil rights, and we can speak for ourselves. Those were radical ideas, and they had to find people in the Psychiatric Association who would listen to him and to people like him. And you know, take them into meetings, listen to them in forums, and begin to think, maybe they have a point. Maybe we ought to look in the mouth of the horse and see how many teeth there is instead of debating it, you know.
When I think about the McCarthy era, one of the very first things I think about is the blackmail associated with homosexuality and the big hoo-ha. It wasn't just communists. The homosexual and communists came together. The fear around homosexuality is just unspeakably large for many people. Is that part of what we are watching as we hear you tell this story through time, that the fear is diminished or people are coming to terms with it, or that this is a reality that you just have to suck it up and get ready to say, I'm not going to be afraid of that anymore? Because this fear element, of, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, Kameny?
Kameny.
Is the one who time and again shows up in your book as somebody who is willing to stand up and put himself at grave risk. Now, he's had less to lose because he couldn't get a job. But over and over again, he was willing to deal with people's fears.
He was unafraid. He was totally unafraid. And but it took a man who was totally unafraid to stand up and begin to let people who are afraid of homosexuals see one who was unafraid. I mean, that's, you know, that's what makes the difference.
I go back to McCarthy because this is a deeply American circumstance.
Uh-huh.
This isn't something that just happened when Anita Bryant got up and got outraged over orange juice or whatever. It seems to me that you are talking about large issues in a large social context that, as you look at those 30 years, that the fact that McCarthy and the McCarthy era had such a direct relationship with issues around homosexuality is an important part of this story.
Well, it's the only... there was a very real witch hunt in the early 50s. Congress and the White House were involved and formed policy, you know, which said that homosexuals are a threat and they shouldn't work in any responsible job. They shouldn't work in the federal government. They shouldn't be in the armed services. We should find them if we can and root them out. You know? And that was the atmosphere in which Kameny was arrested and radicalized. And that was basically a policy of the Republican Party then. And the two parties and the difference between them began to be evident from that time, 50 years ago, to now. Because if you come forward all the way to 1992, to the election, when Bill Clinton began appealing to people who were gay for their votes, and key figures in the Republican Party, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, began using homosexuals as a sort of boogeyman, you had a polarity, and that was what developed a national gay vote, which made a difference in states like Georgia, where Bill Clinton won by 16,000 votes, and almost certainly that difference was made by gay votes, by people, many of whom had voted Republican before. My point is that part of the long theme in this book is that homosexuals had to find, in political terms, had to find a home. They had to find friends. They had to find a party that was willing to seek their votes, want their money, and it became the Democrats. It wasn't the Republicans, because the Republicans found money in attacking homosexuals. So it's a long progression.
When we come back, you used a word earlier, zap.
Mm-hmm.
may not be a familiar word, and I'd like to. It raises some very interesting issues about how to change the world.
That's Bill Russell. I'm Paula Gordon. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin. We are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, and we're all going to be back in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are talking with Dudley Clendenin, and we went away talking about Zap, which has a very particular meaning and history within the lesbian and gay movement.
It's a verb. It's
a verb, and it became an event. and the victims were usually politicians, although sometimes
some
they were writers, and sometimes they were churchmen. Zap was, it was gay political theater, and the idea was to embarrass, to confront somebody who opposed gay rights, or even also sometimes liberal politicians who were presumably friendly, but who wouldn't do anything for you, not really do anything for you until you embarrass them by confronting them in public and saying, when are you going to do something for us?
Well, that's really part of what I found interesting about it, just, you know, thinking about it. John Lindsay, as an example,
who was the mayor of New York,
fairly liberal, at least was saying that he was on your side, but got zapped more than once. I think he was a regular candidate.
Poor man at Rockefeller Center in front of the Metropolitan Museum, almost everywhere he went for a period of time.
There's an argument that I think people would make today that, you know, you don't attack your friends, that it's counterproductive, that it's bad politics, that what you'll do is alienate people. But what I found remarkable is time after time after time, all of that happened. The alienation occurred, and then somebody said, well, we got to do something. And for all of the complaining, all of the objections to it, all the inappropriateness of it, things changed. People finally just said, I can't stand this anymore. It made the changes. And it seemed to happen on a regular basis.
It did. And it illustrates a sort of basic rule of politics, which is that politicians respond to pain. They respond to votes, they respond to money, and they respond to pain. And if you make them uncomfortable, they may actually do what they said they would do but haven't gotten around to. That was the case with Lindsay. It was the case with George McGovern. One of his own political advisors set up a wonderful zap of McGovern headquarters in New York City, in which it was taken over by gay activists who were following the blueprints of the floor plan provided to them and who could chain themselves to the desk.
Provided by McGovern's aides.
That's right. That's right.
Secretively.
Who then came out of his office to confront this surprise ambush and takeover and said, my goodness,
planned.
What's going on here? We'll have to... No, let's not call the police. We'll deal with it all day long with radio and TV folks watching. You know? There was some wonderful theater, particularly in the 70s, and the Zaps were the name that they used.
We went away from your articulating what has changed over time.
Yeah, because Bill was asking really, so what's the end and how close are we and what's happened? And
we addressed one.
Yeah.
That leaves the issue of crime.
Yep, crime and sin. And, now we live now, I guess, in a very mixed time. I mean, a time of really mixed circumstances. If you live in Atlanta or San Francisco or New York or where I live, Baltimore, or any number of other places, and you're homosexual, you're gay or lesbian, you may be protected by a city ordinance. You know, your civil rights may be protected. The Book of the Month Club catalog brings you, gay videos and books to read. You can buy a house together. You can join a club together with your same-sex partner. You can live a life in which nobody seems to think you're abnormal. You can feel pretty comfortable. But it's also possible to live 40 miles away in places like Sylacauga, Alabama, out just outside of Birmingham, and live in a town in which nobody who's homosexual is willing to identify themselves for fear of being killed, as a fellow named Billy Jack Gaither was a couple of months ago. So it's a mixed time, and if you live in those places, in states like Alabama, then you're still the subject of sodomy laws. You're still a criminal. And your civil rights aren't protected. They aren't specified. You aren't protected against discrimination, and you're afraid of being hated and treated as different if people identify you. It's like night and day. It's like black and white, the difference between the two ways you can live in this country now. So when that quits being true, when those two states of being are resolved, I don't know.
Well, that's the chapter I was looking for, I think. And what you're saying is you don't... the appearance now is we've sort of reached a point of stasis. There's certain communities that where people have adjusted and a whole lot of other places where they haven't.
I don't think it's stasis at all. I really don't. I think this is the fastest moving progressive political progression and change in cultural understanding that any group has experienced through American history. I really do. There are states still today which are adopting either state laws protecting gays from discrimination. There are now 10 or 11 states which do that. The vast majority have dropped, or courts have dropped, their sodomy laws. More and more people, I think, see no objection to gay rights, meaning civil rights. What big parts of the culture have trouble with is the idea of gay sexuality, and that's a religious issue.
Which takes us to number three.
Yep.
I think it is important, before we get too far down the line, to add to this mix that which very much changed the course of the movement itself, which was AIDS.
Yep.
And when you put illness in the midst of this that was directly associated with the homosexual population, and the word here is homosexual, that the sexual part just changes the ballgame.
Yeah, AIDS did two enormous things. The first was that it seemed to confirm all the worst things that the religious right was afraid of and spoke of in terms of the effect of gay sexuality. And then the second thing it did was to demonstrate that homosexuals were not strange. I mean, it first seemed to prove that they were, and then as people watched the disease and the reaction of people who, men and women, gay men and lesbians to it, they began to gain understanding and respect because they became, it was mainly a male phenomenon, and they became people's brothers, people's sons, people's nephews, and often people's fathers, the victims, and they became known. And
you couldn't closet that.
No. You couldn't closet that. And you couldn't deny the humanity involved, both of the victims and of the people who ministered to them. And it brewed a lot of anger, which became political anger, which became political energy, and which had a real effect, again, in the election of 92, which is sort of the arrival of the movement, that vote, which had a big effect that we spoke of a little earlier. The end of the story that you mentioned, you know, maybe another book 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, those other movements, the women's, the Black Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, others, you know, other groups are still in the process of assimilation. This one will be, too, for a long time. It's got a bigger lump to digest in the sense of the people who are opposed on moral, religious
grounds. But isn't part of the point that you don't want to assimilate? That you do and you don't? I mean, this is certainly a problem with all those other movements. Yeah, I want to assimilate. I want the rights, but I don't want to be there. I don't want to be a white guy. I want to be who I am.
Yeah. I think basically every minority group, I mean, the process, and I'm, you know, I don't pretend to be an, I don't know if I'm not expert or if I'm mainly expert, but but I have opinions, and I guess my opinion is that the most American experience of all is the struggle to get rights equal to the ones that white Protestant males created for themselves in the Revolution, you know, X generations ago. And it's what every minority group has sought. And what they're partially after in that way is to be like everyone else, and to a lot of them that means being assimilated.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back.
White male Protestant property owners. And that economic, I think, is not irrelevant in this.
We can pick up when we come back with that. Dudley Clendon is our guest. Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, are at the St. Mark Methodist Church. We can come back and talk about the religious part as well when we return to the Paula Gordon Show. Be with us. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are talking with Dudley Clendon. The struggle for everybody else to have the rights of the white Protestant male property owner. That's a struggle that's going to continue for some time, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. It's practically the whole of our national experience so far. I don't know why.
Well, now, let's see. You are white. You are male. You presumably own property.
I own property. I'm a father. I'm divorced. I'm a church-going Christian, you know. Jesse Helms and I have a lot in common.
I'm so pleased you told me that.
I feel better already.
Jerry Falwell and I have a lot in common, you know. The thing is that I'm aware of it, I wish they'd pay more attention. I covered the religious right for the New York Times.
You're aware of the similarities,
that's right.
Is what you're saying.
I'm aware of the similarities.
Yeah,
that's right.
Excuse me. Now tell me about the New York Times.
That's right. I covered the religious right for the New York Times. I was the first reporter to do it, and so I've spent a lot of time with Jerry Falwell through the years, and with Pat Robertson, and with lots of, you know, other preachers and flocks of good fundamentalists, and I have flocks of them in my family. You know, I mean, I'm a Southerner. None of this is strange stuff. It's all familiar, and it's one of the great tensions, and it's one of the great, I guess, presences in this book, is the growth of the religious right, because it grew up in opposition not to abortion. It grew up in opposition not to a ban on prayer in the schools. It grew up in specific opposition to a gay rights ordinance in Miami when Anita Bryant, I was informed by her preacher that such a thing had been passed. And
such a thing?
The gay rights ordinance, yeah. Politicians in certain places got accustomed to homosexuals. They got accustomed, you know, to getting money contributions. They got accustomed to winning elections because people quietly rounded up gay votes for them. But they didn't talk about it much publicly. And so when citizens, other citizens, realized that a quiet revolution was taking place and that politicians were being elected to office who were sympathetic to something called gay rights, and the general public realized they didn't know what that meant, and to fundamentalist Christians who saw it, they thought it meant sexual, a sort of sexual libertinism, if you will. And Anita Bryant worried about her children. You know, that was a genuine thing with her. And so then it took on, things became very different, because that's when real opposition grew to the gay rights movement, because they were opposed not to so much civil rights, but to what they saw as basic sexual energy.
I'd like to. Your book has been compared to the work of Taylor Branch and his mm-hmm. documentation of the African American civil rights struggle. Taylor Branch talks about the Republican Convention of 1964, at which he says that the party of Lincoln turned on a dime and became something else. And he says that from the perspective of the black civil rights struggle, that essentially became a party of the South. It became a party that was race conscious and not altogether supportive of African American aspirations. What I'm hearing you say, and I really thought of this, is you had this confluence. You had this party that had denied its heritage with respect to race, ethnic background, and at the same time you have this other influence that has to do with gender, if you will, mm-hmm. and the end result is a party that today still seems to be very uncomfortable. The Republican Party seems to be very uncomfortable with African Americans, though there seems to be some movement in that direction, but still seems to be uncomfortable with homosexuals.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're dealing with two big electoral groups, and in a way, it started here meaning Atlanta, here in the South. It started in a way with Jimmy Carter, you know, the governor of Georgia, because he was the one who encouraged Southern Baptists, his folks, who were by and large a much more moderate group than they are today, to go to the polls again. They had been turned off by the experience of Prohibition. And they had begun to see politics for a long time before as sort of unsavory, smudgy. They didn't want, you know, they felt tainted by it, and they withdrew. He drew them back into presidential politics, and then the Republicans took them away from him. And the Republican Party, I mean, if it's true, as you say, Taylor Branch pointed out, that the Republican Party turned in 64, it turned again in 1980, because that's when the religious right, which by then had 4 years to sort of grow and get really angry at Jimmy Carter, who is too moderate for them, too liberal for many of them, for many preachers here, like Charles Stanley down the block here, like Jerry Falwell, people who were real critics of Carter, they liked Ronald Reagan. Not at first, because he was divorced, you know, but but they grew to him, and they supported him, and he came to support their policies. Reagan was for gay rights in a way, you know. He a lot of his close advisors were gay. And
well, he came out of Hollywood.
And his friends.
That's right.
The film community is.
That's right. That's right. But he came eventually more to support the position of the religious right in the Republican Party, because they became so influential by 1980 and more influential in each four-year cycle, so that today it is the bulk of the political sort of troops and energy of the party.
You talk about covering the religious right for the New York Times. One of the things that's really impressive about Out for Good is a sense of reporting, that it doesn't give me a feeling necessarily of a screed. that you really are trying to tell me about what has happened in America and in the world over a course of time. I was, not surprisingly perhaps, particularly interested in one way that the movement cuts, that is the real challenges between homosexual men and homosexual women, that is to say, lesbians and gay men. Because it plays so many different ways.
Oh, it's almost infinite, and it seems endless. It's, you know, I don't know that heterosexuals understand this very well. They may not have given it much thought, but it really very quickly became clear to us as we got into it that it may be that gay men and lesbians have less in common than any other coupling of men and women across the spectrum, you know.
No common ground.
No sexual energy.
Well, as you say in the book, that nobody has anything necessarily to gain from getting along, which of course is not true, but the obvious things that are sexual attractions ain't there, so there is less at stake.
Yeah. Men from the beginning, you know, were interested in being sexually free because that was the Great Repression, and the sodomy laws were aimed not at women, they were aimed at men. Women suffered for them, too, because they lost custody of their children.
And in fairness, coming out of the women's movement, there was a big drive for women's sexual liberation as well, but it just doesn't look the same.
No, but women have never been historically promiscuous in the way that men, if promiscuity is the word. And their whole pattern of behavior has always been different. And they've been, through the time, the decades of the movement, interested in sort of stable relationships, even whether they were serial or whether they lasted forever. They've been interested in the issues about their children, about their home and domestic life. And men have wanted the freedom to be sexual, period. And so women at various points have sort of thrown up their hands in disgust and said, the hell with you men, you know.
You're talking within the gay, and lesbian rights movement. You're not talking about it.
It's not the only
huge
place.
Chasm, right?
They've
down
also
the
said that in other contexts.
That's right. I mean, women do that with their husbands lots, but women did it with gay men and repeatedly, you know.
At considerable cost to the movement.
The great tension has always been between this sort of need to be not criminal because you're sexual, in other words, to be sexually free, and the need to be able to get a job and not be fired from a job or thrown out of an apartment because you happen to be gay, whether you're actually sexual or not. You know, that's quite a difference, the right to be sexual and simply civil rights. And I don't think those tensions will ever get resolved, but the way they will is if all the sodomy laws disappear and discrimination is not legal anywhere.
This is Dudley Clendenin, and he has written with his colleague Adam Nagorny a wonderful book called Out for Good, The Struggle to Build a Gay Rights Movement in America. We're all going to be back in just a moment. We are back with the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin, and we are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. I specifically say that because it is not an obvious place for a gathering of people concerned about the rights of gay and lesbian people. Or maybe it is.
Yeah, it is, because there's one big, I guess, opposition to gay rights takes a form that's not true of opposition to every other minority group, or there's a difference of intensity, I guess. And the thing, I guess, that gays and lesbians have such a hard time demonstrating to part of the American culture is they're just as moral as anyone else, you know. You know, one of the, I guess, the hallmark of the Black Civil Rights Movement was that it had such moral dignity. It came out of the churches. It's hard for a movement that came out of the bars to convince people that it has the same sort of moral character, that it has an equal sort of humanity, if you will. A lot of people don't understand they were in the bars, homosexuals were there, because they had nowhere else to go. The churches wouldn't let them. If you identified yourself, you weren't welcome. That being said, there have been a few churches through the time of the movement. Universal Unitarian is one, a Methodist sometimes in important places, American Baptist in important places, sometimes Roman Catholic, who've helped the movement, given it space, given it places to meet, because people had no place to meet, no place to go besides bars, where they might be arrested. So some churches have been tremendously helpful, but at the same time, halfway through the movement, when the fundamentalists discovered what they saw as a big threat, they founded their opposition, and still do, on the Bible. I mean, every minority group has had to contend with the same sort of thing, and that almost everyone has been seen as inferior, less moral, less competent, less reliable, less strong, tall, handsome, and American, you know.
But not everybody had Leviticus.
But not everybody had Leviticus, that's it.
Yeah.
And
quote for us why Leviticus matters.
Yeah, okay, I will. Leviticus, that's where that great phrase, abominable and detestable, comes from, basically. And it grew up in Christian doctrine that and that when one man lay with another, it was an abominable and detestable act. And, you know, law, when it began to be written, was based on the Bible. And American law was based on English law.
And it went back to Henry VIII. I didn't know that.
It went back to Henry VIII, to the 16th century. So colonial law was based on English law. When the colonies rebelled, American law became based on colonial law. So that basically by the time of World War II, all sex that was not procreative in this country was illegal. Didn't matter whether you were homosexual or heterosexual. If it wasn't the kind of sex that makes babies, it wasn't legal. And we've come a long way since then. But that's been the legacy that this particular group has had to contend with.
And it was talking about sin.
Yeah, sin. And it's all been based on the church. And so this culture, its whole legal system was deeply based on religious belief. And separating religion from government, separating governmental law from religion, has been a slow process. This movement, in a way, is part of that. And that's still the struggle that goes on. When you try to repeal sodomy laws, that's the larger thing this is about. Part of.
However, an awful lot of this is predicated on a very selective reading of the text.
Yep.
I mean, there are many preachers who were prominent in your movement, who and many who are allies who read the same text and come to radically different conclusions. And there's a line in Faulkner somewhere about, you know, you've taken to proving both sides of this argument with the same text.
Yeah.
And it's that selective reading that seems to be to generate a lot of the trouble.
Yeah. I'm not a biblical scholar. I think my general understanding is that the Bible, is in one sense, is perhaps the greatest committee product in publishing history. You know, it was written by perhaps 100 or 1,000 people over 1,000 years, and most of whom didn't speak with each other directly. And you can find much inspiration and many different points of view in it.
And most of them didn't speak the King James Version of English either.
That's right. The only point I'm trying to make is that there's a huge portion and a huge part of this culture which continues to see homosexual behavior, sexual relations between people of the same gender, as sinful, and they base that in the Bible. And that's a resistance that no other group has to contend with in achieving its rights. That's the hard part for this particular population to overcome.
Well, until you articulated it that way, I really had not thought about this as a separation of church and state kind of an issue, but isn't that some of what you're saying?
I think in a progressive evolutionary way it is, yeah, I really do. I think it clearly is. I feel even self-conscious using this phrase religious right again and again, but Christian right, call it what you will, but one of its basic goals and its existence in the last 20 years has been to to return to state policy its religious views, you know, to make those views, give those views once again the force of law. Now, I think that's a losing position. I think the direction of change is in the other direction, but that's what makes it such a tough fight.
Well, that can take us straight to the political arena itself, which is at the local, the state, and the federal level, if you will. Those have been different fights, but they're all the same fight as well, are they not? Local, state, and national?
They are. This movement started on local levels, and when at different times when it began to seem too hard or to take too long to win at local levels, they moved to the state level, realizing that, you know, you can't win this town by town, city by city. You can pass a law, a state law, and help a lot more people than if you pass 100 village laws. And when that seemed too hard, it moved to the federal level because this is a set of issues, you know, which is national. It's true for a whole national population. And one of the places where this is, I mean, what you can really see this is in Washington because, you know, in Washington, D.C., in the early 1970s, nobody had the vote. I mean,
nobody.
Congress had taken away the vote. The Southern Congress had taken away the vote, lest black folks be able to vote, you know, and screw up the results for them. And so none of the residents of the district could vote, which meant that when they first got the vote in 1971, really in a meaningful way, everybody could organize, could start from the same point. Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, gays, everyone. And the federal government was also the city government. So the federal government, which had conducted the witch hunt, was also the government that you could protest against, you know. And lots of Democratic and Republican senators and congressmen had gay people on their staff. Democratic and Republican congressmen were gay, and lots of them knew each other outside of the office in the evening, and they began to learn from each other, and it was a really interesting mix of the personal and the political, which the book treats in a chapter called particularly The Pink Invitation, which I think is good reading.
Well, the whole book is good reading, but tell us about The Pink Invitation.
Okay. There was a man named Alan Barron, who was one
Barron's
of the famous...
Barron's Report.
Yeah, Barron's Report. He was a famous newsletter writer. He happened to be a completely liberal Jewish Democrat from Iowa, but he had lots of friends, Republican and Democrat, people in the sort of Christian right, as well as Ted Kennedy, Richard Vigory, and others, associates of Jerry Falwell were friends of his. Lots of journalists were friends. And what a lot of them didn't know was that Alan Barron was also gay, which he was shy about saying. But he had a big party, sent out a pink invitation to a party, an inauguration party for Reagan, at the time of Reagan's inauguration, and it was a big gay event, Republican and Democrat. And his house became a place where men who and women, but mainly men, who were interested in politics first, who had a passion for politics, could meet each other. Some of them were straight, some of them were gay, some of them were Republicans, some of them were Democrats. Some of them went to bed with each other, but mainly they learned from each other and they learned to work in the system together. And there was only one thing that Alan Barron really did directly for the gay cause, and that was to write a letter to help establish the first gay PAC, Political Action Committee. And it needed to raise money in order to give money to politicians to win their votes for the cause. And to get the money, they had to have somebody sign it. And they needed Tennessee Williams. And they sent a handsome young man to see Tennessee, and he got his signature. Free, I should add. But it's a good chapter.
Well, there's a good line of what's it worth to you? And the young man
That's
says,
right.
Well, just about anything, but I'd rather not.
Yeah.
This is Dudley Clendenin. We are talking about the struggle to build a gay rights movement in America, and we're going to come back in just a moment to continue that conversation. Please be with us. We are back for a couple more minutes with Dudley Clendenin. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are here at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta. I know people who would really like the word gay back. They don't like that it's attached to a sexual orientation. I have a sense that that's some of America's challenge, that they want things back and that it's never going to be the same.
Yeah. No, it won't ever be the same. And it's not the best word. And I don't know what the best word is. And there are a lot of people who don't like the word gay. And they're not just people who are non-gay who don't like it. There are a lot of homosexuals who don't like the word gay. There are a lot of women who are homosexual who don't like the word lesbian. But gays and lesbians, homosexuals, bi, queers, by whatever name, you know, are part of the American culture and part of the human race and always have been. And what is visible now is that they're involved in a struggle for rights equal to any other group in the country. And that's the only way you can define or measure inclusion in a culture.
We kind of glossed over it, but you were talking about homosexual women losing their children. This isn't party kind of stuff. This is really important, life-altering challenges for what does it mean to be an American, what does it mean to be a human being.
And it's even more basic than that. I mean, it's whether you can be an honest human being, honest with yourself and honest with the people in your life. There's nothing more basic than that. And that's why the policy, don't ask, don't tell, whether it's a military policy or whether it's the classical Southern policy or whether it's sort of the general cultural thing, don't tell me and you won't bother me. That's why it doesn't work, because it forces people to be dishonest. And that's what this movement and most movements are about, simply for the freedom to be, for people to be whom they are.
That goes, Paula twitched earlier when you said assimilation. And your answer, I think, made sense. But there's a sense in which people who are not that white, male, European, Protestant property owners have alternate perspectives that are legitimate perspectives, and they're important perspectives, and particularly in a dynamic environment. The ability to draw on those perspectives, whether it's from women or homosexuals or people of a variety of different ethnic origins, seems to be not only of benefit to those people, and I'm not talking about political correctness here, but that it is of general benefit to the entire society.
Well, we chose the title Out for Good for a reason, you know, and one, because there's a sort of finality about it. I mean, this is truly a population which is out and for good, like it or not, you know, like it or lump it. You can be glad of it, you can be opposed to it, but it's not going to unhappen. And but the other level of that is that there's a sort of moral implication in that, the out for the good not only of the people who are homosexual, but for the good of the larger culture. You've got to be open and honest in a culture, or you have a lot of wasted energy and conflict and pain. And we need to know each other, you know, all of us.
Out for good. Thank you, Dudley Clendenin.
Thank you.
Dudley Clendenin and Adam Nagorny's book about the struggle to build a gay rights movement in America is called Out for Good. We thank them, and we particularly thank St. Mark Methodist Church and its senior minister, Dr. Mike Cordell, for opening their doors to all people. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.